Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Gregory Simelgar. Gregory is an anesthesiologist. Gregory has many years of experience working in the hospitals, healthcare industry. Gregory is also the founder of the Minnesota Ketamine Clinic. We will be discussing the many benefits ketamine has to the individual experiencing PTSD, depression, anxiety, addiction. Gregory will get into his intake process and how he develops optimal treatment plans for his patients. I, for one, am very excited to have Gregory on the show today. And without further ado, let's get started. Well, Gregory, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, just again, I'm really excited to be on the show. I know we're going to learn a lot, and I'm just getting ready to start a series on ketamine because I'm just finishing up psychedelic therapies. So I thought ketamine would be another great avenue to get down under, and it's an honor having you on.
Well, thank you. Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. So what originally got you into medicine in the first place and you wanted to go to med school? And
I broke my arm when I was 10, and the surgery was done kind of it wasn't the most successful surgery in the history of the world. I regained my function and everything over time, but you know, when I was 10, I kind of decided, okay, I'm going to show these guys and I'm going to be a better orthopod. Well, that kind of changed over time. And then I looked at other specialties besides orthopedic surgery. And when I started medical school, I actually wanted to go into OBGYN of all things. And but then anesthesia really drew my attention. And by the time I was entering the match, anesthesia was the obvious choice for me. So I became an anesthesiologist.
When you first finished your residency, what was like the first avenue you went into, or did you get into ketamine right away?
I got a job in the Twin Cities working for an anesthesia group and did a general anesthesia, and that involved pretty much every conceivable type of surgery, starting from routine little eye surgeries to open heart. And I worked in that capacity for about 13 years with one of the groups in town. And then I switched my jobs to and started working for Hennepin County Medical Center and as an anesthesiologist again. And then sometime at the end of 2015, in one of our anesthesia publications, I came across an article about low-dose ketamine and its use in mental health, which grabbed my attention because I never suspected that was a thing. I really looked at that article. I read it with a lot of interest, and that kind of piqued my interest some more. So back in at the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, there were no ketamine clinics in not only in the Twin Cities, not even in Minnesota. We're talking about Wisconsin, Iowa, Dakotas, Nebraska. There was absolutely no representation, even though East Coast and West Coast started to grow their ketamine clinics. We were behind. So I took a dive.
What was it? Just negative stigma? Is that why we're so late to the party?
I think when the new treatment comes out, okay, or the new treatment is being discovered, it is a little bit scary. Do we have enough data to support what we're doing? Are we actually helping people? Are we selling a snake oil? You know, so I did look long and hard at what was available at the time, and it was still a little bit, well, if sketchy is the right word to describe it, but no big scale studies were done at that point. Still haven't, not a whole lot of studies are out there to support what we're doing, but the evidence is growing by day. By each day, there's something new that pops up. So
Well, it seems like ketamine therapy has been getting, like you said, popular for the past 3 or 4 years at least. Isn't it true that ketamine's been really around since like the 1960s for various things?
It has been. And but the properties of low-dose ketamine, or microdosing, if you will, researchers became aware quite recently, relatively speaking. We're looking at probably in the vicinity of about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. 20 years ago, when the first studies started to kind of emerge. And that's when it became more of a thing.
And I don't know if this is a similar issue, but I know with psychedelics, the reason they're being stigmatized is because back in, let's say, the 60s and 70s, people used to use it as a party drug. And from what I did my research, people used to use ketamine as a party drug back in the 80s as well. They called it Dirty K, I believe, something like that, you know. Yep. And
Special K, yep.
Oh, yep. Special K.
And there's still a lot of stigma around psychedelics, and there's a lot of stigma around ketamine to this day. In our social media, we get bombarded by multiple people asking me the same question. They say, isn't that a horse tranquilizer? Yes, in large doses, it is used in veterinary medicine, but you can't discount what we're doing. You can't just call it a horse tranquilizer and stay away from it. We help so many people, and we will be helping a lot of people in the future. You can't just encompass that concept into one bowl of misconception and kind of throw it at us.
So would you say the main disorders that it's been treating is, let's say, depression, anxiety, bipolar, PTSD, and some people even say it's been helping with addiction as well?
Yes, there's some evidence that it not only helps people to stay sober from alcohol, but also helps people to stay sober longer. People who have addiction to other narcotics, for example, there is more and more evidence to suggest that. Now, we have to be careful here because ketamine is not a panacea. It's a lot of people try to make it look like a panacea, and like it helps with migraines. I've heard so many things. It's mind-boggling. People have approached me to help them with tinnitus or ringing in the ears,
yeah.
Suggesting that ketamine helps with that. There are very little evidence that it does. There are people who believe that it helps with return the taste after COVID. And there was a report or two. There are people who approached us talking about sexual dysfunction that helps with some, and there's not enough evidence to suggest that either. But once that came out, the low dose ketamine became a thing. All of a sudden, everybody tries to kind of contribute and think that it will help with anything but the mental health. And sometimes it's not there.
Well, see, me as a mental health therapist, that's what really got me engaged in this, just like the psychedelics. Now, from a biological point of view, it has something to do with the glutamate in the brain, right? It slows it down, or maybe you could tell me a little bit more about that.
Nobody knows exactly how it works. There's a lot of speculation. There's some evidence that we base it on, and yes, the idea is that it works on NMDA receptors, and blocks glutamate from being reabsorbed, so more glutamate becomes available in the CNS, not just in the brain, but also in the spinal cord. And that's why we think that it might be helpful with pain management, chronic pain. Nobody, to be honest with you, nobody knows for sure that's how it works. So the mechanism is still a little bit of a black box. But what we see in practice, and once we determine what exactly is the mechanism, then we may be able to answer the question, why does it help some people and doesn't help others? What would be the optimal treatment protocol, which we still don't have a solid answer to. So
now, going back to doses, what is considered a low dose start? Most people,
0.5 milligrams per kilogram is probably the good starting dose for most people. Okay. There were studies that compared 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, compared it to 0.1, to 0.2, to 1 milligram per kilo. And what those studies concluded, once again, not a big scale studies, not a whole lot of participants, but what they concluded is that 0.5 is superior to 0.1 or 0.2, almost as equal to one in effectiveness to 1 milligram per kilogram. So 0.5 is probably a good starting point for most people.
And in general, it's just safer to start someone on a smaller dose because there's like less like danger as it comes to like a side effect, right?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Always try to minimize the side effects. Always try to optimize the effectiveness of the treatment. Yeah.
Okay. Now, how do you apply ketamine? Because I know also there's like nasal spray forms too as well.
Right.
So I don't know if you do IVs or...
Ketamine can be administered in multiple different ways. IV, intramuscular, intranasal, oral, even rectal ketamine. That's not also an option, but we're not using it. So we usually limit to IV ketamine, and once in a while we would use an intramuscular ketamine. We do employ intranasal, but we don't usually start with intranasal ketamine because I think that intravenous form is superior to all others. If you want me to elaborate, I will.
Yeah, please.
All right. So IV ketamine is superior to everything else because once you've given any medication in any other form but intravenous, you can't take it back. So if I inject a dose in the muscle or if I give somebody a pill, can't take it back or spray their nose. With the slow IV infusion, we can always pause. We can always slow down the infusion. We can stop the infusion if we need to. If the side effects are, you know, emerge, then we can definitely make changes to what we're doing. With intramuscular, for example, we can't do that. It's just not gonna be the case. What we need to take into consideration is how the pharmacology, the pharmacophysiology of things is. So with intramuscular, the serum concentration peaks fairly quickly and then subsides fairly quickly. So it gives more of a psychedelic effect compared to intravenous when we slowly increase the serum concentration and don't cause any significant psychedelic effect. And this brings me to a very important point. A lot of people think that psychedelic effects are closely related to the effectiveness of the treatment, which is not true. Just absolutely not true. And I'll stand by this statement anytime, any day. So we try to minimize the psychedelic effects of ketamine by administering it over 40 minutes or 45 minutes or an hour, whatever it takes to minimize the side effects.
And this whole time they're just sitting in a chair getting the trip effect then for 45 minutes straight? Is that how it looks like?
For 45 minutes, they're in our facility, sitting in a comfortable chair, and we're monitoring their vitals and physically monitoring them.
I'm just curious. So what qualifies a person to get this treatment? Because I'm sure there's some people that don't really qualify or, you, in your clinical opinion, would not benefit from ketamine treatment. Is that true?
Some people would not benefit from ketamine infusions. When we do the initial consultation, we usually disclose that there's no predicting factor. So I can't really, there's absolutely nothing in a person's history, demographics, blood work, nothing that can predict whether ketamine would work or not. There's no genetic testing, for example. So we have to try it before we know if it's going to work or not. So when people come in and so that's the prediction. As far as what qualifies somebody for ketamine therapy, it has to be a treatment resistant mental health condition. Okay, so it can be a garden variety depression, or I'm feeling under the weather, or my family is driving me crazy and I want to try ketamine. It's just not going to be, we're not going to be taking you as a patient. You need to qualify. Most of our patients fail at least 4 different medications before turning to ketamine. Most of them would get a suggestion from their mental health provider, which I am not. I'm an anesthesiologist. So we would stay in contact with their mental health team to kind of coordinate the care.
Okay. So like a mental health assessment.
Correct. The mental health assessment is not done by us, though. We don't do mental health assessment, but the mental health assessment is getting done by a mental health team.
Do you usually have a company that you work through, or you just take any mental health assessments from that licensed therapist or whatnot as a referral?
No, we get referrals from a lot of mental health providers, a lot.
Okay, so have there been times where like somebody did not know that and they just came in like, hey, I heard this is a miracle drug, it works great, I'm dealing with a lot of depression and anxiety, let's go, and you're like, no, it doesn't work like that?
I can think of a few occasions when we get a phone call I want to try this. Well, what have you done up to this point? Well, nothing really. Well, do you have a psychiatrist? No, I don't. How about a family doctor? Sometimes family doctors manage mental health. No, I don't really have. I never brought it up with my family doctor. So you want to try ketamine as a first line, which is probably not a good idea.
Okay. And another question I have is too. So let's say if somebody was taking an antidepressant, would you need them to be completely off like all anti-anxiety or antidepressants before they get on ketamine for sure? Like,
for the most part, no. Actually, we do encourage our patients to take their medications as prescribed, unless the prescribing physician or prescribing provider, I should say, tells them that you should not be taking X, Y, and Z. But until then, they should stay on their medications. There are very few of them that interfere with ketamine treatments, and we discuss those with the patients on an individual basis, but we do not ask them. So the best way to describe it is, and this is the analogy that I use, if somebody is diagnosed with high blood pressure mm-hmm. and they're placed on a medication A, and medication A helps somewhat, but not really, and then it stops working, most of the time they're not being taken off of medication A, but the medication B is being added to the mix because medication B works in a different way than medication A and complements it. And sometimes medication C is entered in addition to A and B. So ketamine is one of those things that works in a different way, and it may complement what is being done to that point. And it is basically, it works in addition to, not instead of, other treatments.
Okay. I know this is a little off topic, but would you ever consider having a mental health therapist actually work for you, as well as psychiatrist?
Mental health provider to work for?
Yeah, me? Yeah. You guys all in the same building, so you just keep everything in-house?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without hesitation.
So that may be a future goal of yours?
It's been a goal of mine for a while, but it's hard to find somebody who is willing to take a risk with the practice and the practice that is ketamine based and kind of did what I did, jump head first.
Okay. So. Now, through my knowledge, though, it is FDA approved, right?
Spravato is. Spravato, the intranasal spray, is FDA approved for the use in treatment-resistant depression only. At our clinic, we're not using Spravato.
So what risk are you really talking about when we get really in depth? Is it like a professional's reputation that might be at risk? Or what do you mean by that?
Or
jumping onto ketamine, like getting onto the ketamine train, working with ketamine. You said there was a risk.
Well, there's always a risk when you start something new, and there's always a risk when you are kind of exiting your comfort zone and starting something that is outside of your normal realm of practice. And yeah, there's always that element. Plus when I first started, okay, so I read an article and I read some studies, and they suggest that it works 2/3 of the time. And but when you start practicing and you see it, you know, firsthand, what it does, and you see the effects that it has on patients, and you go, holy cow, it actually does work. So, it's one of those moments when you're like, okay, I'm doing something right. I'm doing something good.
So honestly, like, what's the worst story you've ever heard of with someone taking ketamine? Like, for the most part, the worst part is like they just don't get any positive effects from it.
When it doesn't work, it doesn't make mental health worse. It just doesn't. It doesn't do the desired. It doesn't achieve the desired effect, and that's heartbreaking for everybody. Because keep in mind that the population that we see is people who had mental health problems for 15, 20, 30 plus years. And then they're tired. They're tired of living like that. They're devastated by they're debilitated by their illness. This is their hope. And if it doesn't work, it's another crush that they've experienced. And I wish I could help, but there's only so much we can do.
Right, right. And honestly, can I ask your personal opinion? I know I've been talking about psychedelic therapy a lot. What is your personal opinion on that realm?
Like on MDMA, psychedelic?
Yeah, DMT, MDMA.
There are studies that need to be done. There's definitely something out there. I am not saying that, I'd be the first one to jump on the bandwagon when, let's say, microdosing of LSD mm-hmm. proved to be, this miracle help for let's say, PTSD, for example. But I want to see where it's gonna take us. But the wheels are starting to turn, and there's some research done in the area. So it's exciting. It's exciting to see that there's some alternatives to what traditional therapies are offering.
So I'm just curious. Let's say someone walks in your clinic, they get approved for treatment. And we'll just say, for the heck of it, they got severe depression. So they do the one session with you or one of your other professionals for, let's say, 45 minutes, right? For the 5 milligram drip?
0.5 milligrams per kilo IV infusion, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How often do they do that? Do they do that a couple times a week, a month? Like, what could that be?
So protocols differ, and the one that we employ is maybe different from other clinics or other places. What we found most helpful is 3 infusions spaced very close together within a week, about every other day, followed by 3 infusions once a week after that. So that's the initial kind of a treatment protocol that we suggest to most of our patients. Once again, I use the word suggested protocol because it's not, one, it's not set in stone. Two, there's not enough studies to support that this is superior to, let's say, doing it once a week for 6 weeks. Because there was no back-to-back comparison. For example, Spravato people who developed Spravato, Janssen, they never did studies comparing intranasal or Spravato to esketamine to IV ketamine. They just never did. I found that peculiar, but for whatever reason, they decided not to do that. But regardless, there's got to be studies that show that what I do is inferior to any other protocol. So I'm not saying that my protocol is the best protocol in the world. It may or may not be.
Now, have you ever had clients that just went up to you and said, oh, my God, after 1 week, I just feel amazing. This is so great.
Once in a blue moon, we have patients who, after one infusion, they feel so good, and they want to wait until they do the second one. And we actually encourage that, as long as you want to, and just let's keep in touch. If you need us, we will bring you back. If you don't, and there's like I said, it doesn't happen very often, but once in a while, just one infusion. Get somebody really in a really good spot, and we see them again for the treatments 2 through 6, which is fine by me. I actually encourage that. I would love to see that more often. One infusion and then it helps.
Okay, so they could be like scheduled, let's say, for like 3 infusions for like 2 weeks, whatever, but like you said, they're good after the first one. You don't really pressure them to do more. It's like, all right, you're good, right?
We work with them mm-hmm. to determine what works for them. But once again, doesn't happen very often. And we don't schedule people for all 6. We started out with 2 and see how they do with that. And then if it doesn't help, then doing more is sometimes is not beneficial. They're probably not going to benefit. Some clinics do three, some clinics do four before they call it. I do two before I say, listen, we're in that area, very touchy area where doing more may not be doing more. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I do that because of the lack of the insurance coverage.
Yeah, there we go. That's the name of the game, right?
Unfortunately, it is.
Yeah.
I still don't know what the big hang up is.
So yeah, the therapy world is killing us too. It really is. You know, just when they determine what's really adequate as it comes to like the number of services for whatever you're doing for the client, and it could be very extremely frustrating.
It is. I agree with you. I would rather them reconsider and take a closer look. And for example, if they're talking, if the language that insurance companies do understand is financial, I don't think, yeah, it's the mighty dollar, but even if you look at it from purely financial perspective, it is still much cheaper to do for them to pay for the ketamine treatments than it is to pay for the ECT treatments, which require general anesthetic, a longer stay in the facility charges, et cetera, et cetera. Ketamine infusions would cost them less than the cost of admission. And of course you can't really put a price tag on a human life. Somebody who is suicidal, and if two ketamine infusions will get them off of that ledge, there is no price that needs to be paid for that. I mean, that can be attached to that. It's just plain and simple. It's a human life, for God's sakes.
That's what we want to really say, though. Okay, what is a human life worth to you?
Right. You know, right. I mean, to me, as a layperson, it seems obvious. To them, it's probably not. And I'm not sure why.
I hear horror stories about, I think this one particular example, there was like a teenager and the parents brought them to the ER because of suicidal ideations, and they were having thoughts of killing themselves and everything. And the insurance company said, nope, they can go. They're on their way. So like the staff had no choice to like send the family out. And then a couple days later, he ended up committing suicide because the insurance companies thought, oh no, they're fine.
That's heartbreaking. And, I'm sure that there's more to that story. I'm not trying to defend insurance companies by no means, but I'm sure that there is more to that story than just a simple, no, we're not going to pay for it. I don't know what was driving them. Once again, keep in mind that I am not a mental health professional. I am not a psychiatrist. I can't really pass the judgment in that area. But I'm my two cents about insurance coverage is they need to take a look at it again. And perhaps if we get our politicians involved, a lot of them are talking a lot about, most of them are talking a lot about mental health and the help that the veterans need, and the VA that is in bad shape. Well, let's do something about it, for God's sakes. I mean, this is relatively inexpensive compared to other treatment modalities, compared to other treatment options or lack of treatment options. Well, this is something that is going to help a lot of people if we can get at least partial coverage. I mean, that is as simple as that.
Right, right. And it's funny, I was just watching a YouTube video. This guy, his podcast sounds like Psychology in Seattle, but he's talking about just this very thing. One point he did make too is how important documentation is, because you can somewhat understand it from the insurance point of view, where it's just like, okay, if you're doing poor documentation and not explaining the client's condition well enough, then they're going to be like, yeah, of course, like, you're not really giving us any information. So no, we don't think he needs services if you're not going to provide, again, adequate clinical information determining his depression and levels, his anxiety levels. So that's where I feel like it falls on us a little bit too.
Most psychiatrists do such a good job documenting and doing a very thorough examination. When we receive information from them, it's very comprehensive. So insurance companies would not complain about that, because most people do a really good job. At our clinic, on our end, every infusion we use electronic medical record. Yeah. So it's not you know, good old pen and paper kind of a thing. Yeah. We do very thorough kind of documentation of every step that we take with patients. That part is covered. And I'm sure that if insurance companies become involved, I'm sure there will be more regulations and more paperwork for us to fill out. But it's a small price to pay compared to what can be done with the potential of ketamine infusions. At least if the treatment is available, it should become available to more people, especially people who cannot afford it. And breaks my heart when we consult with somebody, and the price becomes the only deciding point. It just breaks my heart. But I can't offer free treatments, because then the clinic is going to close, and we're not trying to get rich off of it. We're trying to provide a service, and yes, it is for profit. It's not all altruistic. However, we've tried to do the right thing by people, by providing a good service at a very minimum that we can charge.
So I know this is a tough question. What do you say to those people who cannot afford it? Do you give them like another referral, or like a second place intervention? And I know that's horrible to say, but
we offer everybody that we can join them in the fight against the insurance companies, or with the insurance companies, or petitioning on their behalf. We can try. Most of the time we're not going to succeed just because of a hard stop that a lot of them, a lot of insurance companies put on ketamine. Medicare is being the biggest offender. That's where if we can change Medicare's approach to ketamine therapy, the others will follow the suit. But Medicare has this no ketamine coverage whatsoever policy. And it's a hard stop for them. There's no discussion. There's no exceptions, at least that I'm aware of. There are no exceptions. So, yeah.
So, Gregor, what do you think we have to do as professionals? Do we need to advocate more? Do we need to complain more or protest? How do we change this, you think?
My suggestion would be to get our local government involved. Petitions would be a good start to have our voice heard. And starting a petition is fairly not that complicated to do, actually. It's fairly easy to do. I would suggest to start with that, to start a petition and try to convince the local government and our representatives who were elected by us to actually get involved with providing adequate mental health care for people who need it. And even if you just look at Minnesota, there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people who need that. So
it's always the ones who need it the most who don't have it.
I know. I know. And unfortunately, I know too well, because I'm on the receiving end of a lot of that anger. And I don't think I can do anything to change that just by myself. And when I suggest to some of the people who express a lot of concern, hey, let's start a petition. Mm-hmm. Well, that's when the crickets come into play. You know, they don't want to do that. Well, why not?
Fear.
Let's do it.
Fear. Let's do it.
It just, yep, start the signatures. Start getting the signatures, and a lot of people will sign it. But it takes somebody to actually take action. And yeah.
So I want to go in a little different direction. So you are now at Minnesota Ketamine Clinic. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about your facility. I know you have more locations, right?
Yeah. So we started with our main location is in Woodbury. It's called Minnesota Ketamine Clinic. It's in a nice area with medical buildings around us, with some restaurants, some boutiques, but it's kind of a business area. And it's a nice location. And then we expanded into Fargo, North Dakota. So we have a clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, and that was about almost 3 years ago. We recently opened I partnered up with with my colleagues, and we opened a clinic in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Yeah. So we got a new location, and that's been functioning since May, and gaining a lot of momentum as we speak. So those are three main locations. I'm consulting one of the psychiatry practices in Wisconsin, in Madison, and we started doing ketamine over there as well. So
okay, do they offer all pretty much the same services then in each one?
Not exactly. The Wisconsin one is different because it is an existing psychiatry practice. So they have psychiatrists on board, and psychiatrists, psychologists, they have a huge staff of nurse practitioners, and they evaluate their patients, and they basically refer patients to ketamine therapy by themselves, and they have staff to administer ketamine, and I just consult in medicine.
So the only two the professions that can administer it are, let's say, nurse practitioners or like medical doctors?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Mm-hmm. And specialties of the medical doctors kind of vary. A lot of nurse anesthetists took initiative to start ketamine clinics. Because of the familiarity with ketamine, that's one, and two, ability to start IVs and, you know, quickly and efficiently. So a lot of nurse anesthetists or CRNAs started practices by themselves. As far as physicians go, most of the time it's either psychiatrists or anesthesiologists, but I've seen ER doctors starting ketamine clinics. I've seen family doctors starting ketamine clinics. So a lot of some psychologists started, but I'm not sure if they're working by themselves or there's a nurse practitioner working with them.
Okay.
So,
and just curious, when you work with your patients, do you ever suggest to them, hey, ketamine might be good, but I highly suggest mental health therapy as like a dual treatment along the way?
We always suggest that they need to have a mental health professional's involvement, whether it's a psychiatrist or a counselor, a psychologist, psych nurse practitioners, or even their family doctors who are really good at managing their family of their mental health. We suggest for them to continue with their mental health team, not just rely purely on ketamine.
So. Okay. So I just want to go back to, so how many ketamine interventions do you apply to one person? Was it 6 or 8? I forgot the number.
6.
6. Okay. And let's say they're feeling really, really great. Is there a lot of cases that they don't come back to you for like 6 months or a year? Like what's your, I guess, miracle story?
That's what differentiates us from other clinics. We don't mandate when or if they need to come in. Because for some people, one or two infusions may be enough. For others, 6 is basically gets them out of their rot, so to speak, and they can be, from that point on, they can be managed with more traditional treatments or therapies or the combination. So I don't ask patients to come back for a certain number of treatments afterwards. Maintenance is optional, and I'd be more than happy to discuss it on the individual basis. And then we found out that some people don't need maintenance infusions and some people do, but at different time intervals. So it's not fair, especially when the treatment is not covered and it's an expensive treatment. It's not fair to ask people, oh, well, you need to come back, a certain number of times. It's just sometimes it's not necessary.
Well, it's funny because I have, like, when I think about like antidepressants or anti-anxiety, individuals take those medications like every day for years, years, and years. And something, like you said, with ketamine, and correct me if I'm wrong, it permanently changes some function in the brain. Like you said, it like manipulates the receptors in the brain to an extent, right? And it prolongs that effect.
But not permanently. That's key. It's not permanently make permanent changes. For most people, it does not at all. The changes are temporary, but the changes are enough. And it's hard for me to speak to that extent, just because, once again, I'm not in mental health, so it's hard for me to kind of determine or say with a degree of certainty, this is going to help you for 8 months. No, it is just not. It varies from individual, but it's not a permanent change for the most part.
No, it still fascinates me though, just the like type of effect it can have on someone though. It's really remarkable.
Correct. Yeah. And it's just, like I said, the first time my first several patients, you sit back and go like, holy cow, this actually works. And then just, wow. Mm-hmm. So I am doing something useful with that. Not just kind of starting an IV and then, but it actually works.
No, it kind of reminds me of something, but obviously completely different and much safer, is back in the day, the electric shock therapy, mm-hmm. where they would like shock patients. And some people would say it would kind of have a positive effect, but then they would have to like go back because it's really not that permanent change, right?
Well, ECTs are still electrical analysis therapy. It's still a gold standard for treatment-resistant depression and is still a good treatment for some people, and it is still a great treatment for somebody who has a history or has a treatment-resistant depression and, let's say, has elements of schizophrenia. Ketamine may not be a good option for those folks. But like I said, it's not a clear-cut kind of a approach to mental health. It's not a one-way approach to mental health. It needs to be multimodal approach from different directions under a good maybe team effort to treat people for mental health with mental health problems. And just having one anesthesiologist is not going to do it. But having a team of physicians or practitioners to approach this and to kind of do a right combination of therapies probably would be ideal for people with treatment-resistant mental health problems.
Excellent, excellent. No, and Gregory, thank you again so much for being on my podcast. But I do want to ask you one final question. Just with your career and your passions, what are your future goals moving forward, let's say in the next 5, 10 years? What would you say?
Well, I want to grow hair. No, I'm just kidding. don't know. If you would have asked me that question 5 years ago or 6 years ago when I first started, I would say I don't know where it's going to take me. I would like to be able to offer more services, and not by myself, but in addition, adding somebody to our practice to help with mental health. Yeah. There's several things that are besides psychedelics that are out there, and I know you're concentrating more on psychedelic approach, but there's a lot of advances in the TMS treatments, transcranial magnetic stimulation. There's a block that can be done that goes in the side of the neck that helps with PTSD. Yep. You can inject a numbing medication in there to kind of reset the nervous system. Yep. And there's a lot of research done in that area, and those are just a couple of things that are kind of out there, not mainstream, but they're available. They show a lot of promise. So if we have another conversation 3 years from now, I would like to look back and then say, okay, it's probably going to be different.
Well, me too. Like we were talking about earlier, funding's the name of the game, right?
Yeah, I hope if insurance companies would jump on board, that would be a game changer. Mm-hmm. Let's not reinvent the wheel and come up with this super expensive esketamine. That's not the way to approach it. Make it available to people who need it. A lot of people who need it. And then we will see, and then we can conduct, studies, and we can actually help a lot of folks. So,
amen.
I hope, yeah.
Well, again, Gregory, it was an awesome pleasure having you on. Now, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular way they can contact you?
Probably the best way is to go through the website, mnketamine.com. There's a phone number listed there. They can contact us through social media. We're on Facebook. We're on I think that's the only platform I'm on. But I'm not on Twitter, even though we have an account. But the best way to get a hold of us is probably through the website and giving us a call and letting us know what we can help with.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, I had a blast having you on the show. I really did.
Me too. I appreciate your time, and thank you for making it available to your listeners.
I again want to thank Gregory for an awesome BHI episode. I also want to thank my listeners for supporting me. I just want to inform everyone that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health issues, seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health professional. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.